Support for today's episode comes from Squarespace. With beautiful templates created by world-class designers, Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website in just a few clicks. Squarespace's analytics also help you grow in real time, and if you have a question, their award-winning 24/7 customer support is there to help. Think it, dream it, make it with Squarespace. Head over to squarespace.com for a free trial. When you're ready to launch, just use the offer code TEST, T-E-S-T, and save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain.
Hey, let's start the show.
For Thursday, September 28th, 2017, welcome to This Is Only a Test, the official podcast of tested.com. Hello and welcome everyone to this week's episode. I'm Norm, joined by our crew this week, our standard crew, Jeremy Williams.
What up?
And Kishore Hari.
I'm part of the standard.
Yeah, welcome. You know, we had a good week last week without
you.
You set
the standard.
That's a better joke.
You are par.
You are average.
We are all back in this week, and we all return. We all made a return. A little bit of time travel happened, because since we saw you last, the three of us went to the past.
Oh, yeah.
We're back to the future. Back to the present.
I thought you meant this morning. You mean last Thursday.
Yeah, I do mean last Thursday. Thursday... for those of you who regularly listen to our podcast, you might know that I am a big fan not only of the Westworld TV show, but also the closest approximation you can probably get to that today, which is in San Francisco, an immersive theater experience called The Speakeasy, which transports you to a 3.5-hour, basically, theater show in a underground speakeasy set in 1923. San Francisco. And last Thursday, Jeremy and Kishore and respective... significant others,
yes,
all went, and I went for my third time, and I would love to hear your impressions, because we haven't talked at all about this since last Thursday.
I didn't even see you after it.
No.
Because we got thrown out at the end of various exits, and I just caught a cab.
You got a cab, and you went home.
Yeah, I would say my first review is, you guys clean up nice.
Yeah.
We all got a little fancified for it.
You have to. For people who don't know about the show, maybe didn't hear Norm talk about it before, it's a 1920s experience set in 1923 in what would be an actual speakeasy in San Francisco. And you are asked to dress in costume. You have to dress in the period. And if you don't show up in costume, they say you're going to have to rent one from us for $200.
Is that true?
Yes.
I don't think I knew that.
Yeah.
But what's different about this experience than other immersive theaters is you're not in one giant room altogether. You're separated into some pretty small spaces.
Yes.
And at least early on in the night, it's hard to figure out, before things get moving, who is a guest and who is an actor.
I found that to be one of the most fascinating parts of the experience.
Then it starts to reveal itself pretty quickly. And the storylines that emerge traverse different rooms.
That's right.
So you don't stay in one place. You can travel with the storylines.
You choose,
or have new storylines come to you.
So you choose what you want to follow. Or if you want to stay in the room and follow, find out what happens next.
And in terms of how many people are there, like if you want to put it into the Westworld parlance, there are about 220 guests.
I wonder.
A little over 200 guests. And then the ratio of guests to hosts, the actors and the people who run the show, is, I think, like 3-1. So it's about like 60 or 70 people working the show, you know, front of
there's
office,
a good number of those
office.
People that are just like straight like security and like, you know,
but it's still in character.
Bartender. Yeah, they're in character.
They're all in character.
There's also a technical staff that doesn't get to any of the spotlight, so to speak.
Right.
Because there are some really unexpected things that happen.
I was looking around for where that was happening.
Rooms marked private.
Yeah.
So I intentionally curated the experience and started you off in different areas. There's three primary big areas, a bar, a casino, and a big cabaret. And Jeremy had you and your wife in the cabaret,
yep.
and Kishore, you and your wife in the bar. Tell me how you felt about those experiences. I hung out with Kishore for most of the first half hour, which is like an opening segment.
Man, I mean, just generally speaking, it took me hours to get into the vibe of it.
What does that mean? Like, when you walked in...
I hated it. And
what?
And I loved it.
Now, what?
These are the two feelings I was wrestling with. And I couldn't come to grips with until, you know, maybe the last hour. I hated that I couldn't get the whole story. When I go to a performance...
Serious FOMO.
When I go to a performance, I've been taught that I can get the story if I pay attention and I'm clever enough and I don't, you know, let my mind drift. That's impossible here. You have to choose what story you want to find.
Yeah.
Or you just choose to go with the flow. Just be adrift in the sea of people mm-hmm. and go wherever the action takes you.
I had very opposite. I was instantaneously in it. I mean, it didn't hurt. Yeah, it didn't hurt that we started in the bar. We got some nice drinks. And the first thing my wife said to me was like, ooh, this drink's too strong for me. You drink this one too. And suddenly I was already loosened up and having a great time. But I was into it. And it was pretty quickly came to me which storylines I was most attracted to.
Mm.
And I kind of sort of loosely followed those around and then spent some time just like, you know, let stuff run into me.
It's totally, you know, you enter 7:30, you're out by 11:30. In those 4 hours, you could walk out, and if you really wanted to, you could have no sense. You could have like this vague feeling that something was going on.
Yeah.
There was some drama, some conflict. But you could totally spend that whole evening just drinking or just gambling.
And
that's a valid way to experience that.
And there were people who clearly had too much to drink at the speakeasy.
Yep.
And they just become part of the atmosphere.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
there are these two guys in the cabaret just like yelling, like, you go.
Exactly.
And like, well, okay, all right.
Some people could hardly keep their eyes open. And they're missing all of these amazing performances happening around them. But they just become part of the speakeasy.
Did you like, the past few times I went, it was the cabaret, and... It's what I recommend. If you're going in for the first time, you go in a cabaret, you get a seat, you're watching basically a kind of a stage show. Did you enjoy that feeling of it, walking in and like the band playing and the MC, the comedy MC?
The speakeasy is run by a gentleman named Sal. And Sal is from Chicago.
Yeah.
And, you know, maybe affiliated with the mob.
Mm-hmm.
He came over and sat with us.
Oh, he did? I want to hear about this. Wow.
When we sat down, Sal sat next to us, complimented our attire.
Nice.
Thanked us for coming. Thanked us for getting dressed up. He appreciates when his clientele does
that. That's great.
And he asked us, you know, how we were having a good time. And I complimented the band. I thought the band was swinging.
Band was great.
Six-piece jazz band.
Yeah.
Playing 20s music. Like, that's the band I want to have at my party.
Right.
And he was just a complete gentleman to us.
You were engaged.
Yeah, and then he started referring to the show as if we were regulars.
Mm.
And he started talking about Eddie, and I was like, who's Eddie? He's like, when you get back down from outer space, you come talk to me, because of course I should know who Eddie was, because I'm a regular.
Right, yeah.
So that set up this whole, this notion that I'm not there to watch, that I am there to participate.
Yeah.
And that was another part of the experience where that is not always a comfortable feeling.
Mm-hmm.
And as you walk through the space, and you can do that anytime you want to.
Yep.
You can leave, if there's a performance happening, you can leave the room, go to the casino if you want. As you walk around, you're not sure if someone's going to come and engage with you or not.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you're not really comfortable approaching performers.
You're not supposed to.
And engaging with them.
Yeah, you're only supposed to stand by, and if you are engaged, it feels very privileged.
Yes.
When a performer, because they have their scripted parts, the hosts, like just like in Westworld, you like they'll target you, and they're an NPC, but you may get a chance encounter. Chance encounters with NPCs.
I had a hard time sleeping that night. I loved it.
You're thinking about it the whole time.
I can't wait to get back.
I love how committed everyone was. What is it like going three times, though? Doesn't it get old? You kind of figured everything out.
It is like playing a video game where, you know, playing a four-hour video game and knowing that I know the beats. There are parts of the environment that I want to be at this time of night. and I feel and I, there are parts I want to see for sure because I love the performances, but there are parts like, okay, I've seen this bit or I've seen this, I was in this room. If I've seen something twice and I'm seeing it now for a third time, then I know I'm missing out in the other rooms,
yeah,
some other things. So I'm trying to curate my own sense of direction without really keeping track of time, which rooms I want to be in, what are the stories I want to follow. There's a whole room, I don't know how much time you spent in there, but a whole there's a dressing room where the dancers and the performers, they go into a dressing room with a mirror and you see a one-way mirror, and you can actually, as part of your experience, you can look through the one-way mirror in the seating area and just watch their backstage conversations.
That was one of my favorite rooms.
And some people sit there the whole time and they get a whole honest part of the story.
I was so enveloped in one of the performers' performance in the cabaret.
Mm-hmm.
She left to run backstage, and I left and I went into that room so I could watch her go into the changing room and just follow her story.
Mm-hmm.
She had a rough story, let's just say.
Yeah.
Was it Velma?
Yeah.
But it was
know who he's talking about.
It was fascinating that they have this performance that takes place through these different rooms, and all of them have to be synchronized.
Yeah.
And there's sometimes where they wait a long time for another performer to join them in the room, but they're in character the entire time.
Yep. They'll be dangling around. I think in the Barkashore, when we first walked in, there were people sitting. We didn't know who was performing, who was not. And they were chatting. And then suddenly they do these directional cues where lights would dim down or because none of it's amplified, right? So like they're not mic'd up. They're talking in their normal speaking voice. That's why you have to be quiet. But then lights will either point at them or the room will dim a little bit. And there are points like, this couple they could have been attendees, they could have been performers, and suddenly they had a whole bit that they exchanged while everyone was quiet.
I think the weirdest part is a couple days later, Norm and I are having lunch, and we spy one of the actors.
No.
Yeah. From the night, he's like leading a tour group.
In San Francisco.
Like, through the city. Day like job. On a day job kind of thing.
What character was it?
It was the slice of pie guy.
Oh.
Yeah. Man in the hat.
Huh.
That was the weirdest part of the experience.
I want to never associate these people, these performers, with their real worlds. But I also had, for the weird Westworld experience, was the last time I saw this was beginning of the year, and actors had changed.
Hmm.
And so they had swapped out the models, the same lines.
Yeah,
but it was very much the Dolores thing, like in Westworld, like, do I have the same connection? Because this isn't the same person that I recognize and as the last time, but delivering the same drama.
Your actors were back at the office being operated on.
Yeah, or they had been retired, phased out.
In the basement, in the dreary,
maybe,
damp basement.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Would you want to go a fourth time?
Not anytime soon. I think, like, if you make the most out of it, two or three times, probably.
Yeah.
I feel like, for you guys, I don't know if you guys feel like you want to go back, but a second time, after you leave it the first time, I feel like you really want to go back.
I really want
to go back. It's like a time portal. Like, take me back. Take me back to 1923. I want to be... It's so festive and
I want to know,
so jovial.
And not just more about the stories, but just like more... It's more than a story.
It's a great...
It's something you experience.
It's
like, I know how the bar ends. If you're in the bar at the end of the night, I know how that ends, and I know what that vibe is about.
Yeah.
And it just stuck with me, and I was like reviewing some of it the next morning. There's a song that's sung, and I found that song.
Right.
I want to know like what's going on in the other rooms in those. I want to experience those.
That's why
those scenes.
We ended in the cabaret the first time, and my wife and I, we say we want to end the cabaret every time because the feeling there, it feels so good.
Oh, you only ended in one room?
Yeah,
that's crazy.
Because we like it. We like
that's
that
weird
feeling. We're like,
that's weird.
We're not always.
It was
back
a fun
there
vibe.
So you
in
don't
that
even
room
know what I'm talking
I
about.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Okay, that's crazy. All right, because I would do these out.
Comparing notes. Comparing notes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Highly recommend it.
Westworld is real.
It is.
That's all you need to know.
People, they're talking about making it a mainstay, like a San Francisco.
Oh, it'd be great
staple.
I think it needs to travel. It's
any,
so good.
It would
they
be
can't
hard
make the space.
They can't.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's dependent on the space, but it's such a good local experience because they weave so much of San Francisco in this. I would love to see this in another city.
Were there any disappointments you had in terms of like what you expected going in, how immersive it was versus like how much interaction you got? Like,
I didn't end up interacting with more than one character the whole night, and that's just by chance. So I have a little FOMO about that. That's about it.
No, Eddie grabbed my wife and dragged her down the hallway.
What?
She dressed like she like grabbed me as she was being dragged away.
I still don't know who Eddie is.
Eddie Cantor, or it's basically Eddie. Eddie's the MC.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And he's hilarious. Right. Yeah,
yeah.
But think of it this way: what you realize is like there are a couple big personalities. Sal being one of them. Yeah. Eddie being one of them. Sal, the owner of the speakeasy and the lead MC. Because there are three primary rooms, and everyone starts off differently. Everyone needs exposure to these characters. So when you don't see them on stage in one room, they're doing their bit. They don't have any downtime. They're going room to room.
Yeah. What I want to see now is, besides going back, I want to see a book or documentary about the making of this performance.
You want to see the book?
I want to see the, how do they direct something like this?
Yeah.
Because you, even as the director, you'll never see it in one take.
I don't think they can do that unless they revamp like a different storyline. Could they have a different, like, just like in Westworld, is there a new season where they have the same characters a year later?
Oh, that's good idea.
Like a whole, like a writing the sequel
then
would
they
not be easy.
Reuse the space.
Yes.
Why not? It could just turn into Samurai World.
Dude. I would go to every season.
Every season, a new set of performers, new characters being introduced.
Yeah. And you know what? You asked if I was disappointed. No, I was not disappointed. Everything actually exceeded my expectations. But one thing I particularly did not expect was it's not just a campy speakeasy simulation for 3.5 hours. It gets weird and deep and
it's
tragic.
Yeah. There's drama. It's very San Francisco in many ways in that it's ties to the city. They referenced a lot of places in San Francisco. And you got them through the filter of 1920s, of course, in the earthquake and the rebuild and the exposition. But also it ties in a lot of themes in San Francisco. There's a lot of, you know, some politics in there. So you're having a good time, but, you know, there's something for everyone.
Yeah. More, please.
Yeah, I know. And it's live theater. A different type of live theater or live show, perhaps. Maybe not as immersive as a speakeasy.
Hey, there's going to be some immersion in this show.
In which we will be the hosts as opposed to the guests, is our own live show. So I want to let people out there know that we are putting on our fourth annual Tested live show. It's called Tested Deconstructed, end of October, October 28th. In San Francisco at the Castro Theater. We've been there all 4 years, part of the Bay Area Science Festival, and we're really excited about this year's lineup. Many of the Tested team are going to be there showing off projects. Simone is going to be in town having a new project, and we have some friends from the Tested family and the extended maker community.
We've been in some rehearsal phases right now and some of the build phases. This is insane.
Insane.
What are we doing? It's like I had this like moment of reflection yesterday. We were having Norm and I were having a conversation with Alan Pan, who's people might know sufficiently advanced. He made the Mjolnir that had an electromagnet in it that stuck to the like sewer grates and stuff, so people can like lift up the hammer. And we were talking through his performance, and at one point I just remember like being like, "This is insane!" in like the best way possible. I have to say, of all the great performers, and there's, you know, folks from Science Friday coming from their Undiscovered podcast, Kenji, an old friend of ours, doing a food segment, Alan, and Simone's doing something really ridiculous.
It might work.
I have to say, the one I'm most excited about is what you and Sean are doing.
Oh, thanks, man.
No doubt. No doubt. It is so Bits to Atoms in its translation. And what you're doing is just so profoundly. I've never seen something like this executed before on a live stage.
Well,
and I just went to Speakeasy, so I just want you to know that like this is a big marker. Not to like put too much pressure on you. I'm just really excited about that.
It also only might work, so we will see.
That is a danger with all of these things. That is sort of Adam's mantra. Failure is always an option, right?
That's right.
Let's keep it open.
And so tickets are available now. You can go to the website or it's Eventbrite.
It's tested2017.eventbrite.com. I think there's just a couple VIP seats left if you want to come to the meet and greet afterwards with Adam Simone. I will be there.
We'll be there. And we'd love to see you and say hi. And we will record the whole thing for people who don't live in San Francisco or can't make the travel. It'll be posted soon after on the site. But let's get to some pop culture news.
Culture. as I was driving away from the speakeasy in the taxi cab, I couldn't escape the feeling that the taxi driver might be an actor. You know, it was that level.
Are you basically wandering through your life? You're like, are you real?
Basically.
Wow. I know we keep talking about it, and it's something that, but the first time I went, it was Chinese New Year parade. So walking out at the end.
Oh, wow.
It was firecrackers and like smoke everywhere. At so really midnight? Like walking through a haze
yeah.
of like time travel, like wow. Wiping our eyes from a 1980s fever dream or something. Yeah. Anyway, in big pop culture news, at least for our audience, you guys out there, us, Star Trek Discovery finally out.
Oh, yes.
So let's talk about Star Trek Discovery.
Well, I think for the lead-in, we should say that we recorded a rewatch of DS9 just now. They'll be up for premium members soon. So we are very much in a Star Trek mindset. Mm-hmm. Some of us in a better mindset than others. But I have to say, going into Sunday night, I couldn't wait for football to end and for Discovery to come on. I was so excited. How did it live
really?
Up to expectations?
You were excited. You don't temper that. You don't go in with a guarded sense of this could be good, could be bad.
You know, I initially was coming in with like a guarded sense. I hadn't sort of built up expectations. But come Sunday,
wow!
Like everyone was talking about it. My wife was talking about it. Like, it's a new Star Trek. It has been how long since we've had a new Star Trek?
He knows.
Yeah, since actually I never watched Enterprise, so I don't know. I believe that was 2005. Enterprise.
So this is the sixth Star Trek TV series.
If you count the animated series, right. Seven.
Right. I don't.
Many people count the animated series, including the Star Trek writers, as just part of the TOS, not its own separate series.
By the way, I was going to recommend the animated series as a thing.
It's not bad.
Instead
yeah.
of DS9.
Well, no.
No.
Hold on.
No. We're not there yet.
Okay, sorry.
Okay, Discovery. So it definitely, we felt its impact in pop culture. People were aware of it. People were talking about it, at least people we know. I don't know how into it mainstream was, but, you know, it's Star yeah. Trek. People care about it. Maybe not as much as Star Wars, but people cared about it. The first episode aired on CBS. And then at the same time, they dropped the second episode on their digital app, CBS All Access. And we've watched part one and part two, or yeah. episode one, episode two. I think they really fit as a two-parter.
Yeah, definitely.
What did you guys think of the first episode? Not the first and second, the first episode.
I was very mixed about it.
I see you went into excited.
I went in very excited, and I was... So the thing I was down on going into the show, based on the trailer, were the Klingons. That's not much of a spoiler, right? Mm-hmm. Are we fine to talk about Element?
Yeah.
And that's the thing I loved in the first episode. I love the Klingons. I love the kind of fanaticism, cult-like, warring nature that was coming through loud and clear. And then I liked her, Sonequa Martin-Green. I thought she was great and kind of
Michael Burnham.
Yeah, I thought she was sort of funky. It was the rest of things. It felt very Abrams, like lens flary.
Yeah, very much so. Same color palette,
which I didn't totally like draw me in. And then the rest of the crew, there was just nothing there. Like the Doug Jones character, I just want to punch in the face.
Who's that? The Scabby
science,
face?
Yeah, science yeah. officer guy.
Yeah.
So I feel like I didn't get much from the crew yet. So watching episode one, I was like, I'm there on elements of this. It's a really different Trek, though. It was not the optimistic, explorer-centric Trek that we're used to.
We talk about multiple things, right? One, you're talking about, on the Klingon side, this initial fear that it would be retreading some existing ground in a way that is retread for the sake of retread, a reboot of Klingons. And I think I was just on the fence, just like you, but I don't think I was convinced. I'm still in the place where I'm like, do I need to really? We've had Klingons in every series. They've been a big part. We've had the history of Klingons. Do we need to go back to Klingons? It doesn't seem like it's a new frontier for storytelling. And then in terms of the production design and it feeling very much, and with the camera angles and the lighting and even the ship designs, even though it's supposed to be set years before Kirk and Spock, it felt very much like an Abrams production design. I felt totally okay with that. I know it's in the shadow of not only the Abrams films, but also, you know, the Orville, which is a clear callback to Next Generation style production design.
What's the Orville?
The Orville, the Seth MacFarlane, the Orville.
You haven't. We've talked about it on the show. Yeah. He, like Seth MacFarlane made like a Next Generation like show that's
on Fox.
Three episodes.
Oh yeah, yeah.
You've seen an episode of that, right?
No. You're like, this
whoa. We got to have you watch that too. Yeah. But I think I went back to what I was thinking in 2007 after the Star Trek reboot came out. At the end of that film, my immediate thought was, I want a TV series with characters like this in this universe. Mm-hmm. It felt like Star Trek. It felt refreshing. And I knew that they couldn't do a TV series with at least those characters, those movie stars. I wanted some type of TV show set in that world. And I felt like this is that.
Yeah. Are we just talking about episode one at this point?
Yeah.
That's as far as we're going here.
Yeah, because
we did see it. To be honest, we all saw episode
three. We will talk about episode two.
Okay. But you asked about the first one. I love, in episode one, I love the captain. I am sold on her.
Michelle Yeoh.
Yes. Yeah. She's fantastic. I love her expression. She embodies being a captain. She is open to advice. I think, if anything, the only thing I didn't like about that episode is just how open to advice she is from her first officer.
It's a different captain style.
Yeah, I suppose so. I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe that she would not have enough of her own initiative. I wanted to see more of her big ideas rather than taking them from her first officer.
You saw that in the desert scene.
Yeah, but that was a little cheesy. A little bit.
It was cheesy. I mean, this is more like Frontier Trek. Like, they don't trust their systems yet even to work. There's a lot of like, we're just kind of flying by the seat of our pants, which is TOS style.
I don't dig the costumes too much. They're way too similar, samey. Everyone's wearing the same thing. I like the color differences between the different positions. And, you know, just don't dig on the blue and the silver bits.
The shiny, almost sequin-like accents.
I think what surprised me is how much money they spend on the whole freaking thing. I mean, it feels like a movie.
It does.
Super high budget. Great effects, great practical stuff. Which I didn't expect after that first teaser trailer of that ship coming out of the space station.
Right.
Like rendered on an Amiga.
Yeah.
So I was super impressed by that. I think the Klingon design is super awesome, way outside the box, and great makeup, as well as good acting.
Does it bother you that it's fully subtitled?
You know that you can turn those off.
No. I mean, just the fact that they're not speaking English, that it is this...
Oh, I love
like,
that.
Like, that real staccato kind of vibe from them. And the way they've set this tone, they're never going to... It seems like they're never going to...
I do like that.
Speaking... I like it, too. I think it gets more immersive.
Yeah, I don't mind that. I mean, if they weren't Klingon, it would be some other thing, and it would just be like, well, how come the other series didn't know about these guys?
Universal Translator wasn't built in your TV then.
I kind of agree with you. If we didn't have the baggage of the Klingons, would that really change anything that we saw?
It would have more questions and more, like, it doesn't need to be, oh my God, it's a reveal that it's the Klingons. Oh, I remember Klingons from Star Trek. They're the big adversaries.
Yeah.
I guess the redeeming factor here is that it could be setting up what they want to do, making this a prequel, is setting up how original series started off, with there being a big conflict with the Klingons and why there are tensions and how this territory got established. And we're going to learn things about the Federation, and that's fine. But that's Star Trek itself is just digging into its own past.
Okay.
And it's like, this show could have been set after Voyager.
Can we move on to episode two?
Yeah, so the big recommendation, and we're going to go into spoilers, is that if you watch the first episode, it ends on a cliffhanger that to me felt super abrupt. You got to give episode two a chance because those two really fit together as a pairing. They're part one, part two of the series, of the opener. And I think together, so now we're going to talk about episode two, it sets the show off on a really strong foot.
What do you think about their new communication holograms?
I like those.
Yeah, that's
I love those.
I mean, that's more advanced than anything we saw.
Yeah, than on screen.
Than even Next Gen or DS9.
Yeah. I love the way they really smartly made those so that whoever was being communicated were still talking to people off screen.
They were walking around the room.
I mean,
that was kind of interesting.
I love it.
Makes you wonder, how are they walking around the room?
It's why I felt like this show has... the technology thing bugs me as a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
Like, is this retro? How retro future is it going to be?
Yeah.
It could have totally been set further into the future.
But I also like that it is unpolished. Like, it was more Minority Report style than
glitchy.
We saw it a little glitchy. We see later in DS9 something like that, except it's all polished. and works super well.
Right, right. It's not perfect holograms. These are early holograms.
We see some new Vulcan powers.
Yeah.
Did not like that.
The Vulcan subspace telecommunication.
It's very draining on the human body, on the physical body.
Mind meld time.
Yeah, I don't know. That was kind of interesting. Why not?
Because it's like it was totally unnecessary. That's why it was like
it was
what
unnecessary.
What did that do to advance the story?
She could have had her own, you know. Epiphany.
Yeah, I mean, like if they had been like if he didn't call her via subspace and like had some other way that they talked,
it would have been fine.
Yeah.
It could have been just an internalized.
Yes.
That's what internalized I was saying. Yeah, thing, she right. could have had her own little internal thing.
What did you think about the big battle?
Now that I thought was fantastic. You got to see Klingons be more badass than Klingons had ever been.
I get jaw dropped.
Holy cow!
There was a jaw dropping moment in that episode. I'm like, wow!
It was gorgeous and it's so violent that fight for a Star Trek battle,
which is divisive. I mean, a lot of people are thinking like you can't. They did, so you can, but it feels very un-Star Trek like to start off with such huge conflict.
I mean, Insidious. Just like nasty.
But then at the same time, right after the battle, it kind of reset itself because of what they did in response.
Yeah, sort of. I mean, I think... So my only concern about that battle is that they blew their entire budget on that battle. That battle was so expensive looking. I was like, oh, I guess we're not getting any more space battles the rest of the way.
Right. It could happen.
So I do think it set a different tone for a Star Trek series. Like, we're getting more of a war trek than we are getting anything else. And that is not what I expected.
Is that what you want? Are you okay with that?
I'm okay. I loved where episode 2 ended. Like, our hero is not a hero. Like, leaves that episode.
Who is the hero?
It really feels like a video game where... You know, you start off and they have to give you all your powers and then they reset you and earn them back again. Like, she was going to be captain and then, nope, earn your way back again.
So you're saying the human Vulcan is the hero?
Yeah, of course.
Michael Burnham.
Yeah, she's a star.
Yeah.
Great.
So what's different about this one is this feels much more her story than the story of a crew.
Yeah.
Right? And so that's the thing I'm not entirely comfortable with.
And that could be because it's serialized in that way. You're following one perspective, one person's journey, and maybe on the flip side, the Klingon's journey as well.
I have a hard time with her as the hero because I actually don't like her as a character. I think she is mutinous. I think that she did commit a crime. She absolutely shouldn't have done what she did, and she should be in the brig. She should lose her stripes in the whole bit.
But that's where it's at. That's what's happened.
And the fact that she she regrets what happens, but she does not have any remorse about that decision, that she would have done it again. I don't want to watch that character.
The remorse comes at a point at the cost of personal conflict.
She has no
inner conflict.
She has no proof that her plan would have even succeeded. In any case, she shouldn't have done what she did.
I think we're going to find is the things that the nitpicking fans are the most trouble with is the logic. Because for a character that's supposed to be so heavily invested in logic, that's the defining one of the defining traits of her character, there weren't a lot of logical behaviors. I love the scene where she escapes from the brig with the logic argument with the computer, though.
Yeah, that was funny.
Yeah.
That felt very Star Trek to me.
That seemed a little not Star Trek to me because I don't remember ever... A human being able to change the decision of a computer before?
Hey, we're in a different world now.
It just shows
your computers.
It shows how unpolished the universe is.
Yeah,
like she's gonna edit the registry next week. It's gonna be like something like that. And I kind of dig that.
She's gonna have words with the computer.
And she's definitely look before you leap, or leap before you look. Sorry. I think we've physically got that. I'm kind of fine with her being an anti-hero here.
Yeah. So the question is. Given the strength of the first two episodes together, is that compelling enough for $6 a month for a subscription service to watch the series?
So you figure 10 episodes, are they taking a break at all?
They are. First, it will be is it 10 total?
Are they weekly?
They're supposed to be weekly, but I think there's a couple weeks that they're off. So you're figuring you're going in for this for like 3 or 4 months. So is Star Trek worth $24-$30
or just all in at the end, right? Can't you just watch them all? Yeah, you could.
This is the one thing where I don't think I need to watch it week by week I mean, in the modern day, the binge at the end, or buy it on iTunes at the end if it's available. Buy the set and binge watch them. Or so I don't feel like it's a water cooler. I mean, as much as we're talking on the podcast because it was the first episode, but I don't feel like it's a week to week. Oh, did you see what happened on Star Trek last week?
I totally agree because it's serialized, and that's why it screams bingeable to me.
Well, yeah, but I would think you would disagree then, because people would want to watch it every week because they can't wait to find out how last week's keeps going.
I'm fine with serialized Trek waiting.
You mentioned that it's a different tone, and that's what discourages me, if anything, about this show, is that I really miss the optimism and, I don't know, just this feeling of that Next Gen had, and even the original series of being Gene Roddenberry's vision of the future, contrary to, you know, sort of the popular "it's gonna suck" mentality. And so I'm afraid that it's kind of lacking that, and I hope that they evolve the series to become something more optimistic and, you know, maybe bright. But on the other hand, it's a very good sci-fi show, even if it is grim and, you know.
It was much more gorgeous and evolved in how it looked than I expected, especially for a show that's really just living on the web.
Yeah, I mean, it's an expensive show. They're about $7-8 million an episode for 15 episodes for the first season.
Seriously?
Yeah.
That's crazy.
Talking about like 10 years ago, 15 years, 10 years ago for Lost, $1 million for a pilot would be considered groundbreaking. And now they need to find a way to make this survive financially. And I don't know how the numbers work out, if they decide to air this on CBS or on cable, if that could support the budget that required for this type of show, or it would be, if it would have been smarter for them to scale down on the ambitions and make it a cheaper show to produce, but then give it a wider distribution. Like, what, as a fan, what do you want? Like, do you want like them to shoot for the moon and potentially bomb out after a season? Or would you like them to come with something more sustainable, but more cookie cutter, you know, NCIS?
Go for it. Go for it. I say, like, swing for the fences. I think Westworld, Game of Thrones, all those serials that have driven so much fandom on the premium networks is the model they should go after.
All right. Okay. So moving on to other Star Trek talk, going back to 1993, the premiere of Deep Space Nine. We've talked about it for a little bit. We are going to embark on our Deep Space journey. Deep Space Nine rewatch.
What is this? It's like I'm stumbled into the Twilight Zone. I never agreed to this.
Yes, well, you did.
No, I didn't.
Welcome to Tested, where you just get signed up sometimes.
You're signed up. We know you've been watching Next Generation, Jeremy. We wanted to start watching DS9 as you were watching DS9. Talk about some of the episodes. And we actually, all three of us, just came out of recording a totally unauthorized commentary of the first episodes of DS9 Emissary, the first hour and a half. And that will be on the site soon. But we're going to create
a premium.
Yes. But we're going to, on this podcast, week to week, maybe not starting next week, but we're going to go
every
through
now
the
and
series.
Again.
Yeah.
We'll go through some of the better episodes.
Yeah.
Definitely. Not much of a spoiler here. Jeremy was not impressed.
Jeremy was so unimpressed.
I sat there. I came in for 80 minutes. I had a sandwich. I enjoyed watching the show with you guys. I learned a lot.
I sat there. That's the best description.
I mean, I was present. I came in. I made it. I woke up. The thing is, you guys have so much nostalgia for this show, and you have the experience of watching the entire... what is it? Like, how many seasons?
Seven seasons.
And I don't have that. And so I'm watching it with fresh eyes. I think I might see some imperfections maybe that you aren't capable of seeing
great.
Anymore.
That's great. We
that
want
that
really fresh
good.
Perspective.
On the other hand, you know, I don't want to offend you guys because you do have so many emotions tied into it.
Everyone is valid. All opinions are valid.
Let's just say we spent a lot of time talking about Avery Brooks acting and... slight overacting.
There is not disagreement in any.
No,
any
we all agree.
We all agree the overacting is there. But you look for. There are great things about this show that you don't get, I think, in Next Generation and Voyager. We're not ready to talk really dive deep into it yet.
But you agree, Next Gen is a superior show.
Next Gen is the one I grew up with as a child, and I think Next Gen has maybe some of the best standalone episodes in Star Trek.
Yeah.
But as a cohesive show.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine was way more groundbreaking.
There is no doubt in my mind that DS9 was is my favorite Trek. It has the most social commentary, which is really the legacy of Star Trek. It has more, much more character development, as much more characters that and frankly, it has episodes that linger with me longer than TNG ever did.
Hmm.
My favorite Star Trek episodes ever are in DS9.
Okay.
Let's move on to a topic that's maybe a little less divisive among us. Our excitement for Andy Weir's next book, his second book, Artemis.
What do we got? November release?
November 17th. Yeah, I mean, we're excited for a book release.
I think you're going to get some mild disagreement over here.
Well, you're not excited?
I'm not excited because I cannot allow myself to be excited because of how much I really loved Martian, the book, especially.
I mean, you got excited about the new Star Trek.
No, but this one I'm specifically... Like, this is, it's, Andy's, like, technically his, like, third novel. He's written a lot, but this is his second real mass novel.
You're saying he might be a one-hit wonder?
I think it's hard to follow up.
The Martian. It is.
And I think the putting pressure on a book is where it's a solo author, singular vision, that's a lot to carry, especially with the success of The Martian.
But I think we're also, in this age, we can find book releases in the same way that Harry Potter and also maybe less The Lord of the Rings, but book gets getting picked up and turned into films. The news this week is that there's already directors hired for the Artemis film, and this is doubly exciting because I hope the book's good, but if the book's good, then I'm going to even look more for it. There's a compounding effect here because the directors for Artemis are Phil Lord and Christopher Miller.
How
do I know them?
Directors of the Lego movie, and most recently, the fired directors from the Han Solo film. 21 Jump Street as well, and 22 Jump Street.
You'll think you'll see like a falcon going in the background just exploding.
I don't know. That's but funny. I think they have... These are some of those talented writers and directors and working in Hollywood today that I've loved almost all everything they've put out. And I'm this gets me really excited because I think they can do humor really well. And I think Andy's writing benefits.
Andy does that too,
from humor. Yeah.
All I want to know is, was Andy Weir under any scheduling constraints, requirements by his publisher for this book?
I don't know.
And if not, I'm 100% excited for this book because I think he can pull it off.
The only thing that's given me pause is there's been some short interviews with Andy where he said, unlike The Martian, he hasn't been able to share this book because of how much anticipation it was.
He got a lot of feedback from
that. Yeah, so even to his mother, he had to hand her a physical copy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And so The Martian was driven a lot by him reaching out to so many like scientists and researchers and all these people across the spectrum to build that universe and then, you know, push in his style. So I hope it doesn't lose that element because of the secretive nature of which he had to write this book.
And when you're in the fast-paced world of book publishing and I guess in Hollywood filmmaking, you are surrounded by a lot of yes people and you may not get honest feedback.
Yep.
Those are our big two pop culture bits this week. Let's move on to some tech. Let's start off with some Apple talk. iPhone 8 is out. 8 Plus is out. Reviews have been quite good. There's some great photos of those. And, of course, a lot of people are still waiting for the iPhone 10, which we're still, at least right now, a month away, exactly a month away from being able to pre-order.
Wall Street Journal has confirmed, or at least they suspect, that shortages will be due to this shortage of the 3D sensor.
Really? The face sensor.
The face sensor.
And not the screen, not the display.
Rather. That's right.
Shortages are never a good thing. Artificial or not, it's not good for the consumer. Good for resellers, I bet. And then also other, I think, regulatory departments in overseas have confirmed battery size and radios in iPhone X as well. Mm-hmm. So a slightly smaller battery than, I believe, what's in the 7 Plus or the 8 Plus.
Yeah. Even though the reviews have been good, the demand has not been there based on what we saw at stores for the 8.
So
I think this is all about the 10.
Which is so weird. I think I know plenty of people who went out and got 8s because they don't want to spend $1,000 on a phone. And Mm-hmm. They're happy with the camera on this new phone.
Yep.
I haven't held an 8 before yet, so I don't know if the finish on the glass back is as noticeable a difference as people have said.
It's got Touch ID.
The new portrait lighting modes apparently have worked really well, so excited for that. And of course, everyone who has 7s and 6s can also update to iOS 11. Apple did make some background changes in iOS 11. They've now changed their default Siri search from Bing to Google.
Yeah, that was a reversal, right? I mean, they used to use Google. And then the big breakup happened where they switched to their own Maps app.
Google was still a default for Safari, but Bing, mm-hmm. and you could always switch between DuckDuckGo and Bing and Google, but the default. So the reports were that Google was paying Apple a significant sum just to be the default search engine for Safari.
Yeah.
But for Siri, which is increasingly, I think, how people on iOS use search, you were getting Wikipedia results, you're getting Wolfram Alpha at some point,
right.
But it made a lot of sense, I think. Google has better knowledge graph information. And so I don't know how the information is being displayed.
This has everything to do with money, don't you think?
It's just who paid more, Microsoft or Google. Yeah, and I guess it's Google. At least there'll be some continuity between the default searches. And these are just defaults. Yeah. Again, you can change them all if you want to between what's available in the listing. And have you updated iOS 11? Kishore, you're on Android, of course. I also recently updated to iOS 11. What do you think about that new control command center?
Oh well, I've been using the beta, so I'm kind of used to it. But it's fine. The command center is fine. I mean, it's a little weird because you can't tell what things are initially, but once you learn where your favorite feature is, you just go there.
I don't know these scroll sizes for brightness and
why
and volume, because that tiny bar mm-hmm. is not wide enough for me to get my precise
really
brightness.
Really get in there,
I want the precision.
Can't you get deeper by holding it or something?
You can pop up like things like Wi-Fi. You can add more. So there are a lot of hidden features in iOS 11. And Wall Street Journal had a great video, a vertical video, showing you some of these features. Vertical video. It's just a lot of that these days. Screen recording.
You get bigger.
Okay. Yeah. I see. All right. Yeah.
I've wondered, just a quick aside, I've heard that the battery life for iOS 11 on old devices has not been great.
No, it's bad.
Which is the same situation on Oreo. So
9 to 5 Mac. Somebody did a Twitter poll, and it was like the 60% of people said it's dramatically worse.
Ugh.
Yeah, it's bad for me. I've actually lost battery twice since upgrading.
They've gone down to 20% and gone all the way down zero.
Yeah.
That's a way for them to get you a new phone.
My success.
That's bizarre because the new phones, some of them have smaller battery capacity, but you get better battery life because of the architecture on the chips.
I feel like and it's also choppy. A lot of times an animation will supposed to be happening on screen and will just
choppiness is death.
It will just snap to where the animation ends.
Yeah.
I feel like we are past the point where I should be seeing those kind of things at hardware upgrades. I feel like hardware was powerful enough 2 years ago to support my phone for the rest of its foreseeable future.
Well, this is Plan Obsolescence and experience.
I know, and that's what kind of bugs me, is that they are still doing this when it's completely unnecessary.
Right.
And there's nothing about these animations that require more processing power.
Except that they want to build more complicated animations or put more background tasks in.
I don't believe it.
Because the new phones can do it.
Yeah.
So they're optimizing not for your old phones, they're only optimizing for new phones.
Exactly. Yeah, there's no reason these things couldn't work on these phones. I mean, if they want to add all the new hardware features they want to the new phones, more power to them.
Mm-hmm.
But the old phones, we are way past the point where I should be seeing frame rate drops.
Did you see this review of the iPhone 8 camera from one of the photographers who went to India and did a great deep dive into the portrait lighting effects? It was really it was surprising. Some of these photos.
What do you think about that? You're talking about the new feature where it uses the 3D sense, not
the depth
just
map.
To do depth of field, but to actually change the lighting on the subject. I haven't used it, obviously, but the samples that I've seen online look oddly fake. I mean, not faked in that they're Photoshopped, but faked in that I'm not sure I like the effect.
There's one, the studio one, I don't like that effect.
Mm-hmm.
There are two modes, like the way they surface them. Austin Mann is the name of the photographer, and he had an early access copy of the iPhone, and he does this comparison. So there's portrait mode, there's natural light, studio light, contour light, stage light, and stage light mono. The last two, stage light, which darkens the background,
mm-hmm.
and stage light mono, which darkens the background, makes it grayscale. I don't like that at all. I don't think those work.
Removes the background.
It basically makes it blends it so it looks like it's black.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
It's stage light. I don't like that at all.
Yeah.
But what they do with the natural light and the studio light and the studio contour light I actually do like. And if you look at if you go to AustinMann.com, MANN.com, like some of the lighting effects look really nice.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's all in combination with the bokeh blur, and you, or you can turn it off, which is also something I didn't know. You can have the artificial lighting effect with the portrait lighting mode, the depth map, but also flatten out the back if you don't want to have that blurry back.
Okay.
Which sometimes you want to do when, because the way it blends, the way it like crops out your face, they're not smart enough to get like little wisps of hair, for example.
Right. It just looks like a big blurry.
Yeah. Cutout. Yeah. But some of these photos are unbelievable, shot with the iPhone 8. I'm just astounded. I mean, it's best of the best, right? It's not about giving the best photographer this tool and adding, you know, how much is it the tool or is it the decades of experience the photographer has? It's what can the average person do with this tool, and over time, does that change the style, the language of photography for the masses? You know, if you look at the 90s, look at the 80s, you're talking about, you know, Polaroids, and you're talking about, you know, Kodak film.
Yeah.
Now we're talking about, you know, 28 millimeter equivalent focal length for selfies for everything. So what the evolution of how we see ourselves and how we see the world changes based on the tools we have in our hand.
Oh,
and that's
no,
increasingly both hardware and software.
I was looking in my Google Photos at some of the photos I took with my G1, which was my first Android phone. I think there's one like floating around here behind us somewhere. And comparing it today, it wasn't just the quality looks better, like the composition looks better. So the photos are definitely teaching me something, because I haven't taken any photo classes since then. I haven't really learned anything about tape photography since then.
That is the, I think the secret to Apple is that hidden in simplicity is complexity. And over time, just getting your 10,000 hours in of doing something simple as hitting a button changes the way you think about
it. What the hell's going on here, Norm? That sounded like you were Phil Schiller up there.
He's Malcolm Gladwell.
Yeah, well, he did Gladwell it. But I that mean, was very, like, Apple keynote of you just now. Hidden in the...
You got to say it with a British accent.
maybe not just Apple, but technology in general. Think of, like, Instagram,
yeah.
Right? The Instagram filter was a cheap, simple way for you to get a filter, and people made fun of it. We made fun of it. Like Instagram filters on making your camera phone, your iPhone 5 photos look like an old Russian camera, right? That's the thing we used to say. But that simplicity of making something pop and that populate, you know, giving the population this tool, mm-hmm. Now Instagram users have better understanding of photography and image editing than professional photographers many did 5 or 10 years ago.
Yeah. I guess it's interesting. Like, all the tools are there. I actually use the grids, the rule of thirds grid.
Right.
I just keep that on because it's super easy.
I mean, I'm sure people out there use photo tools and adjust lighting, right? And and now they understand brightness and highlights and contrast and black levels and structure and all of these simple tools were inaccessible.
It's interesting, though, that you say this, because it's all subliminal or just there. It's not like it's
osmosis.
It's not overt. It's not mm-hmm. like Apple's trying to teach you something.
That's the simplicity part.
It just happens.
Through simplicity.
Yeah.
Complexity.
But I wonder, like, why not? Why not have that photo app, when you open it up in iOS 12, say, would you like to take a photo lesson? And they just do like an Apple 1, 2, 3.
I don't think anyone wants to be told to take a lesson.
Yeah.
I think people over time it's like, why would you want to take a class? Why would you force people to take a class before they can use something and not just give them a tool to do things and make them like doing things, whether you get these network benefits or social benefits of sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, you just want to learn more naturally. It's how people learn.
That sounds like a great teaching philosophy. Gamification's right up there.
Yeah, totally. Off of Apple news, big tech news happening. London, which we were just in a couple months ago, no longer has granted a taxi license to Uber.
Why?
Uber has lost its taxi license.
Why?
For two reasons. And this is the first bit of bad Uber news we've heard in a little while. Like, they kind of, after basically dominating the bad news area of tech for a long time, they took a step back for a month or two. Basically, they had instituted a project called Grayball. a couple years ago that was a way of detecting when police officers or enforcement officials would be using Uber, and they would serve them a fake app or fake data in the app, so they actually couldn't ride in Ubers to actually do some enforcement or measurement of how things were going in Ubers. So they were incredibly complicit in making a program to defraud investigators in London. Guess what that usually does? It tends to piss off governments when you do that. So this is a natural conclusion. This is something that's been rumored for a long time. London was always going to be a tough market because, like, London makes no sense in terms of its layout and streets, and the cab drivers are famous for sort of knowing these maps in the back of their mind.
Cab drivers have to train for years before they're given a license.
Exactly. So this isn't surprising. It's a setback. I feel like, at least locally, Uber feels like it's in decline in a lot of
ways.
Oh,
God, really? I don't think so.
I hear more people talk about Lyft. I hear more people.
Yeah.
I listen to Bay Area.
Differently. Yes, absolutely. Like locally here. And obviously we're in a different environment. But
Uber is the verb, unfortunately.
Meh.
I think they beat Lyft to that.
I mean, how long was it? I'm going to TiVo something. Now it's DVR.
There you go.
Language changes.
That's true.
Yeah. Wow. Very good point. Yeah. And you know what? You could still call it Uber. You can still have the brand awareness, but you really can be doing something else. Yeah. Behavior changes too.
And this is the long tail of the punishment of Uber for their in-company behavior. So I wonder how long the
change
is.
Change the way you operate or you'll become obsolete and you'll make your users unhappy. I mean, it's also a question of have they ingrained themselves enough that the backlash for the users, the convenience that these type of services provide will force the consumers to go back to the governments and say, give them back their license. We need this. Hmm. And will that have any impact? Because there are a lot of people who can't live without these type of services.
I don't see a cascade effect. It's not like, oh, London's gone now and they won't work in New York or wherever next. But it's not a good sign. Speaking of a user base that is not thrilled.
Oh, boy.
With a company.
Here we go. Oh, this might be the biggest thing that affect tech news to affect us all this week.
Bury the lead.
280 is the new 140.
You must be talking about Twitter.
Oh, my goodness. So Twitter, for the longest time, since its creation, actually, has had a 140 character limit in various forms.
Why is there a 140 character limit?
Because 140 characters was the limit to SMS. Twitter was used before there were apps over text.
And
you can still text, and you had to text to a number and then have the rest of your characters fill your text. And 140 is still the limit for SMS. And SMS is pretty much a thing of the past.
Not on Android, is it? Whenever I text, I have a 140 character limit to Android.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. Yeah. They don't have their version of iMessage. But Twitter, I mean, no one tweets to it. Tweets via SMS. Most people use apps or the website. And now they're doubling. It seems like another arbitrary number. Let's double from 140 to 280. I mean, they've been making changes like putting URLs or putting images don't contribute to your limit. They've been futzing with it. But there was an elegance to 140.
I don't know if elegance. It just was, it required some level of editing because it's short enough.
I mean, I think they found
140. But it is an arbitrary number.
It is arbitrary, but that number of characters combined with average number of characters in the English language combined with the way text is formatted, so how much information you want to display in a stream, the river, text, the timeline, which is how we consume this information, combined with what type of information you can get across in words, average size, English language in 140 characters, it just happened to work out.
That was a lot.
Yeah, I mean, they're
fundamentally changing that.
Yeah, their justification is that, and they show this in the blog, is their data shows that, especially in English, that there is a significant rise of number of users that are hitting the character limit when they're trying to tweet.
9% of tweets.
9%, but that has undergone a steep curve.
Learn and that's how to use Twitter.
What's that?
Learn how to use Twitter.
Yeah, exactly. So... and they said that's accelerated versus other languages like Japanese, where they don't see as much of a rise in how many people are hitting the limit. I don't think people are mad that this is 140 to 280 as much as why this feature instead of all of these other things that we would prefer.
I think it's both, right?
I'm with Norm. I think you guys are... They're concerned about their stock price. This is why this is happening. They want more people to use Twitter, and they think that longer messages are going to encourage more people to use it because it's too confusing or constraining.
They want it to be Facebook.
No, guys, don't do that. This is 140 characters is what this is all about. Mm-hmm. I come, I want to read my stream. I want to get a very pithy response from somebody, a tweet from somebody. I want all the people who are responding to me to be that pithy because I want to be
concise.
Able to skim them quickly.
Yes.
And it forces you to be concise.
Concise succinctness.
That's what this is all about.
The byproducts of 140 characters create innovations. I mean, one, people edited themselves better, yeah. Right? You learn to be a better writer, hopefully, with these restrictions.
Yes.
Also, it innovated things like putting text on images and manipulating the timeline with that.
And threads and all mm-hmm. these other things that have emerged. Not all of them are positive, by
right.
the way, innovations. We shouldn't make it seem like that.
But constraints force people to think differently.
For sure. I think the funniest thing I saw was somebody edited Jack's 280 character tweet down to 140 without it losing any meaning whatsoever.
That's great.
That's
yeah.
it. Like, you have to learn to do that. And
look, I
here's what I
you.
Would like. I would like a Twitter app, at least the option, mm-hmm. to have every single 240 character...
80.
Or 280 character tweet or anything above 140 just disappear from my timeline, not appear. I want the filter.
Well, then it's like those weird Facebook to Twitter relays where it's like, click here for the rest of the post on Facebook.
Here's my solution. Just don't do this. Because the user base doesn't want it. I don't think it gets you brand new users that like, oh, Twitter can accept longer messages now. They can't be Facebook.
Man, Twitter really wants that Russian money.
Yeah.
They really want that Russian hacking money.
Their argument is interesting. It's interesting that different languages are more flexible on Twitter. I think that's interesting.
I don't discount their argument,
yeah.
but it does discount their core user base.
Yeah, man.
And functionally, they should put in anti-harassment tools in first, because the core users will love that. And I think that'll translate to people talking about Twitter in a different way.
They've gotten a lot of bad rap. I mean,
yeah.
you know, politics aside.
It's only for limited people right now.
It's not a rollout. But yeah. it's a big, I mean, it. They're not going back on it.
They might. They did last time. This came up 2 months ago.
Mm. Yeah, that's true.
So we'll see.
I think if people don't use it, they will let it go by. They'll make it, because then they'll say, don't use it if you don't like it. Only way it's going to get repealed, and the only way that they're going to stop this rollout is if people abuse it and use it poorly.
And that's what will happen, because it's Twitter, and that's the nature of Twitter, to abuse it and use it badly. Though, I will say, for all of that talk, I really like Twitter, and I love Twitter and video a surprising amount, more so than I ever thought.
Hovering to play video?
Everything from breaking news to even I watched a football game on Twitter last year, and I thought it was a better experience than watching it elsewhere.
Twitter is my social network. I don't use Facebook. I don't use Google Plus. I'm only on Twitter. Twitter, please don't change.
Mm-hmm. We're old.
I've been using my Echo Show a lot lately kitchen.
You're the only one.
I think I'm the only one. I got one for my parents so that we can do an easier video chat. And I've actually probably the one person that has really liked this device because it's been very useful in the kitchen. I've even brought up tutorials, like video recipes to watch. And then Amazon took that away from me.
Why did they take away YouTube?
So they took away YouTube integration. There isn't real strong reasoning about why this happened, except maybe Google said, no, we don't want YouTube integration anymore. But we don't know the reason about that, unless it's some sort of larger Google Home ecosystem play, but we actually don't know why.
Yeah, Amazon says there's no technical reason for it. Google decided to pull the feature, and maybe it's a sign that they're more direct competitors. I mean, is it in Google's interest to not have YouTube everywhere?
I totally agree, because I mean maybe Amazon suppressing the ad somehow. I don't know how all of that works. Which would be a reason Google would not want YouTube to play if they're suppressing ads in some way.
Also, Google said that Amazon is breaking some type of terms of service, which is affecting the user experience. No. It's breaking the user experience. Go. Are ads part of the user experience?
Yes.
I mean, if they're eyes, absolutely.
If it's just like not allowing commenting, like who cares about that?
Dude, but Google is allowed to say if you mess up the ads, you can't use our service. They're allowed to do that.
Yeah, that's legitimate.
It's extraordinarily expensive to run YouTube.
But I would say I was really eagerly hoping for the other way, because the YouTube integration via voice on a device in my kitchen was really nice.
Hmm.
I mean, it didn't work well.
What were you searching for?
I mean, most of the time I look for content in kitchen, but like even we, like when we're playing music, sometimes we would just bring up the music video instead, and then it was just a nice extension of the feature set.
I don't think Amazon's going to care too much. People are buying these devices, if they are, not necessarily for the YouTube feature. It's not the killer app. There are now more Amazon devices with screens on them.
Mm-hmm. Out of nowhere,
a big hardware event was held today. And what we have, this is the Echo.
We got a
Plus?
We got basically a supersized Echo.
That's called the Echo Plus, and it's $150.
And then why don't we do the full rundown, and then we'll break them down. And then we got the Echo, what is it, Spot? That is a Echo Dot with a screen.
$125.
Then we got the Echo, what is the Echo phone thing called?
The what?
There is a feature where it's like a $35 box that you plug in to an Echo that allows you to make landline phone calls.
Oh. What, you plug it into like an RJ11 jack?
No. It somehow connects to an Echo device.
So the base Echo is now redesigned. It's squatter. Yeah. It's $100. And
it kind of has more designery elements to it.
Yeah, multi-room audio. It looks softer on the outside.
Well, all Echoes have multi-room audio.
Right. You can buy in a multi-pack. And I think that's going to be a fine device. The thing that's interesting to me is the Dot getting bumped up with a screen and a price. This is the cool product for me.
It looks exactly like the, what's the Andy Rubin thing? Essential had a spec for a thing that looked exactly like
really?
This. Yeah, it had that same design of a sphere with its sort of front cut off for the screen.
Kind of like a Nest.
Yeah, very much like a Nest. So the Essential had the same design with the screen.
It's good looking. It looks like a great little alarm clock. I mean, it's in the place of a Dot. I don't know, probably sounds like a Dot.
I mean, they hid the Trojan horse of Alexa was in the original Echo as sold as a Bluetooth speaker. And it seems like the second wave is now to put these Alexa in things that you would otherwise need in the house, such as an alarm clock.
Yeah.
I actually think it's a great looking product. It seems to have a camera on it.
It does. It does video calls.
Oh, it does video calls.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of cool.
I guess.
I mean, I would wonder about putting this in my bedroom as an alarm clock because it has a camera in it.
I don't know if it can judge you or not.
Triple the price of the Echo Dot. That's the hard leap.
It's 150?
130. I think a Dot is like $40 or something.
Getting up there.
Yeah, that's getting up there. I mean, it's really cute.
Anyone interested in this Echo Connect?
What's that?
The landline. This is the landline.
That's the
device.
RJ11 thing?
Yeah. It doesn't have an RJ11, man.
Well, how does it plug into a landline then?
No, it plugs into an Echo device and allows you to make landline phone calls. Like it can dial over internet to landline.
Oh, like Skype can.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's interesting. No, the thing I'm actually interested in are these little buttons that you can buy for, was it $20 a piece? So you can play trivia games with your family.
What a weird announcement.
Yeah, it's right there. I mean, but if you've ever played the Echo trivia games like Jeopardy, they're actually a lot of fun.
So the device is literally a button that lights up.
You can make these.
Press it.
You could make these, but probably for $20.
and they're $20, and they interact with the games feature on your Echo. And I've just been sitting here thinking, like, what else could these things be used for?
Yeah.
Well, to buy things on Amazon.
Exactly. It's the Amazon. It's the dash button, except a different device.
Are they RGB lights?
Yeah.
Oh,
so they can be different colors.
Pulsating. Oh, you're running. You have a new shipment coming in. Pulsating. Flash sale. Literally flash lights sale. Lights are flashing.
The first 1,000 Echo users to press the red button.
It's like the bag of crap.
Yeah. It's the
siren. Bag of crap, except it's now a flashing button.
Could you imagine?
And it's going to train you. Flashing red. The sale's getting hotter.
Oh, dude.
Press the button.
I press that button every time.
Who wouldn't? It's the octopus. Jeff Bezos bought Woot because it was the breakfast octopus.
Given
and
the
now it's fulfilled itself.
Given the price point, Jeremy, we gotta get one just to take it apart too.
This picture, this Amazon has a press picture of a group of young hip millennials around a table with some pretzels and popcorn.
Oh, laughing so much,
laughing, excited, playing this Echo trivia game. What are the trivia games they have?
Well, there's 20 questions, but that's the reverse. Like, it'll guess you. It'll guess what you're thinking.
Oh, okay. The classic 20 questions games. Those are amazing. If you buy the, have you seen those? Like the standalone 20 questions.
Yeah. Oh, the little computer.
The small computer thing, and you press yes, no, yes,
that's
no.
That's better than what
I does. I love those.
That's really clever. So, no, it's a good question. I don't know what other trivia games there are.
This is a totally ridiculous vice, but it's actually a two-pack for $20. It's not even, like, I'll totally get this to play games with my kid.
Okay.
But it's like, I think the Echo Spot, the dot with the screen, is the most interesting device they announced. And they announced a new Amazon Fire too, with 4K HDR support, but
for only $80 though, so that's like half the price of Apple TV.
But it's like the dongle kind that sticks in your TV, so it has less processing power. I'm much more interested in what we heard about in a rumor, which was the Cube Fire TV that would have a screen integrated and the features of Fire TV.
Crazy.
All right, Amazon doing well. Another company doing well in the home market. Maybe moving to other markets, it's Dyson. You guys use Dyson products at home?
No.
I do not.
Wait. They make the fanless
fans,
right? I do have one of those.
I have one of those as well.
You know,
and thank you to a tested listener out there who told me how to increase the power on that fan without the remote, which I could have used on that super hot day in San Francisco. Huh.
You know there's a fan in that fanless fan.
Yeah, I do. But it's cool. It's like I put it in my daughter's room so she can't hurt herself.
Okay.
Yeah. Yes. Bladeless fan.
Bladeless.
That's what it is.
They're
a bladeless fan. Dyson, maker of vacuum cleaners and fans and hand dryers, is going to move into the EV business. They are going to work on an electric vehicle launching in 3 years, 2020, and they're going to spend a couple billion bucks on it to invest.
It's a lot of money.
You know, it'd been really funny if they announced the electric street sweeper mobile.
That's great.
That would have been so fantastic.
Yeah. Cyclone.
That's Aprile Fool's.
Street Cyclone.
That would be amazing.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. They have good design, and I guess they have a good sense of how to use motor.
No, it seems like such a big monetary investment you would think they would just come in and say, our strength is design and marketing. Can't we partner with a manufacturer like a Ford or somebody? And bring our skill set to bear and make like the Dyson branded electric car, but we're not like investing in the manufacturer and all of those like supply chain kind of components that are really tricky.
I think they see Tesla and Apple and Google all doing this and saying, okay, you don't have to be a car manufacturer to do this. The people having the most success, getting the most positive press, are actually tech companies, and we're a tech company. We can do this. We have a good sense of design and robotics. Let's give it a shot. They're putting a lot of marbles in there, though.
Or do you think there's just like a billionaire meetup and like they're basically like, I'm going to make an electric car, and they're just all just sort of competing with each other?
It was a bet. It was a gamble. Yeah, someone lost a bet. I mean, the British government seems to be putting money into it, and we don't often hear about British companies and their EV and the EV market there. I mean, I think it's good.
You know, speaking of EVs and Britain, England, I don't want to say another, maybe France, I'll look it up, have decided to ban all carbon combustion engines
starting
by 2040.
Wow.
Yeah.
We'll still be alive then.
And California is considering following in their lead.
That's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's a long way out. I thought it would happen sooner than that.
The question is, like, do these regulations, and I know a lot of people are against them,
do they
push societal change? Like they,
of course they do.
They actually change the mentality. Do people look at in 2040 once the sale of combustion cars, combustion engine cars are outlawed? Does that make society? Does that make people less want to have them less or more?
I mean, people have to have a different car. At least in California, I think since there's so many other options and people do buy the electric cars. I don't know. I mean, Are you suggesting, is it like cart before the horse?
Yeah.
Is it like, well, which
yeah.
comes first, the
right.
demand or the supply?
Right, right.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think car buyers care about price and performance.
Yeah.
The two things. The design is subjective, but price is huge. And price is going down for EVs. And certainly by 2040, we hope that technology and the price will scale to a point where they will be comparable. But, you know, they also want that performance. And they want the ability to tweak their cars. Or maybe not. Or maybe the appeal of convenience of autonomous cars will make that all moot.
I mean, I think Tesla's proven that performance is, you don't sacrifice that.
Right, right. I mean, even, you might have to pay for it, though.
Exactly, yeah. But federal rebates help a tad, and the Model 3 certainly is
and you might have
answer to that.
Help to unlock some of the features for performance.
I just feel glad. I feel like my car is 20 years ahead of its time.
It's not 20. Not...
In terms of the, I'm saying in terms of the California mandates.
Oh, in terms of the regulations. Sure.
Yes, exactly.
You guys fly Delta?
Yeah, occasionally.
Sure.
If you're going into the Midwest, mm-hmm. going to Atlanta, going to Dragon Con. Well, if you're going to Dragon Con next year, if Dragon Con was next weekend, flying there, flying on Delta, you would be able to use iMessage and Facebook Message for free.
This is great. This is great because it costs them nothing. I mean, they've already got the internet connection.
It's not about costing them nothing. It's about they're not willing. They don't need to gouge us.
Yes.
They don't need to make the extra money with these nickel and diming
yes.
add-ons.
Good for them.
That they rather instead try to get more customers to buy fill seats with these as perks. But great. Yeah. Completely. It's all go-go equipped flights. We'll have iMessage, but you will not be able to send photos or videos. Now, how is that gated?
That's interesting because you would think iMessage is encrypted and it's just data. How are they going to know that?
Yep.
Yep. I want to know that
fail?
Too.
Maybe that's just tough talk. Or they limit message size.
If it's...
Can if you a, limit message size?
If a flight attendant sees you texting a photo... They'll
aim the EMP at you.
Take away your headphones.
You don't want to fire EMP on an airplane.
This is fine. It's a yeah. nice little feature.
I'm not planning on flying Delta anytime soon. Actually, I might go Thanksgiving, maybe, so I'll test it then.
Do you get the internet on every flight?
When I fly?
Yeah.
If it's more than 3 hours, yes.
That's your threshold?
Yeah. I can do a one-hour flight, an LA flight, or an hour and a half to Seattle without internet, no problem. I will just read a book or take a nap. But 2 hours, I'm pushing it, and yeah. I turn on the intranet, mm-hmm. and I pull down the refresh, the fake eBay page. 3 hours, gotta get connected. You know what I'll do? Sometimes I'll buy the 30 minutes. I don't buy the full flight.
Yeah.
I'll just do the 30 minutes.
And someone needs to make an app that's an internet simulator for that.
The same reason?
Yeah, so like you launch the app.
It's called downloading Wikipedia on your downloading Wikipedia on your Kindle.
Yeah.
I'm starting to get worried about you, Norm. The addict. He gets addict features.
I get the shakes.
The 30 minutes. I wish I had a timer. Just like once it starts, I hit the timer.
Yeah.
And I map out before I put in my credit card the next 30 minutes. What are the things I'm going to do to maximize that time? It's like the shopping spree. It's the internet spree. You have 30 minutes to consume as much as you want, and then it closes.
If you look out the window and you see Colorado, you're like, I can't do it anymore.
No. You do it the last 30 minutes before the descent.
Oh, it's cheaper then. You don't actually go then. You don't buy then. That's horrible. You only got 30 minutes of usage then. You might as well have done
it. No, the 30 minutes before the descent starts.
Yeah.
So which is usually hour 4 and a 5-hour flight.
If you're going to do internet, you got to do it at the beginning of the flight.
No, at the beginning is when I have the easiest time.
On the ground because it's cheaper.
You always
and then
use
the count.
Yes, you always pre-buy. If you want the full duration, yeah, you pre-buy, of course.
All right, we got to do some quick hitters because we're short on time.
This might not be such a quick hitter, but this is a big deal because, Jeremy, you just got a new 3D printer, and it's a Prusa
i3
Mark II.
Yes.
2S.
Yep.
I didn't know about the S.
Yep.
Which was, is this, how new is this? Was the same thing as what we saw at Maker Faire?
Yes.
So the i3
you were really
been
around impressed
for a while.
With that one.
Sean and Simone had built one with Joel Telling in March, and they've been improving with the slicer software.
They've won a lot of awards. Like
yeah,
this printer is very, very high marks.
And Maker Faire was just past weekends, and they were there at New York Maker Faire and won a bunch of awards there. But what got you excited about this printer and what technologies? Because you were.
Well, this is more like what I've been testing, right? I mean, but the news is that they announced a new printer, which is. That's New York Maker Faire.
Oh, the Mark III.
The Mark III.
Oh, so your printers are outdated.
So I built my freaking Mark IIs that day.
Oh, they announced no.
The Mark III. I've never had a product go obsolete so quickly.
Oh,
they're following DJI's model.
Right. Yeah, it is like on a yearly basis.
Tell me about the Mark III then.
So the Mark III is it's really quite good. They have a new Y-axis frame, so it's sturdier, easier to build. They have a removable bed. It's magnetic, so it's not only heated, but it's on flexible steel that is removable, powder coated with PEI, which is an adhesive surface.
Yep.
So the prints, you grab them off there. If they don't just fall off, you bend the steel.
Oh God,
and it comes
that's
right off.
The thing I hate, scraping.
Yeah.
PEI surfaces.
No scraping. And then you put it back. Even if you do scrape this powder coated surface, you don't damage it.
Right.
Like it's on there. And you put it back. You can buy multiple surfaces. So you print, you take it off, put the new surface on, start print, and then work on your old one. So that's quite cool. They also have some amazing new technology. Like they're using stepper motor back EMF. So they can read these stepper motors, and they don't need end switches anymore for the end of the axes. So mm-hmm. the X can go to the end. And as soon as they sense from the stepper motor that there's resistance, they know they're at the end. They can also use the same technology.
That saves on money too.
Yeah, so they can use that to compensate for layer skipping. So that if they skip a step, they can actually count missed steps in the stepper motor. So that if you've ever done a print and then like 18 layers in, it's offset.
How does the motor give feedback?
But they call it back EMF, and the stepper motor controllers is where the magic is. Like these are some amazing controllers that can also do insane amounts of micro stepping. So normally you get. Like a full step is 1.8 degrees around the full rotation of the stepper motor. These can go down to 1/256th of that. So you get ultra smooth, ultra silent stepper motors. And there's also a laser beam that reads the filament so that it knows if it runs out of filament. And it will stop the print, wait for you to put a new filament in.
Oh, that's kind of great.
Yeah, it's.
I mean,
it's,
that's a rare occurrence that you're going to run out of filament.
Not true. I've had it happen. Overnight print, you think you have enough filament in there, there's not.
The fact that also it's $1,000 assembled, $750 pre-assembled or unassembled, it's a great price too.
Same price as their old printer.
Oh,
it's a good deal. The old printer, the one I bought, is now $100 less.
I'm so sorry. Can you get $100
discount?
They're
giving me a credit, so I might get the Mark III like next year, maybe when they come out.
Wow. Well, you don't want to do that before the Mark IV comes out.
Whatever. I mean, this is a really sweet printer. It also prints twice as fast, so it's really has Ultimaker speed printing now. So it's a very compelling printer. People are quite excited about it.
Wow. Do you know when they'll start shipping?
Couple months, November.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, but by the way, the Mark II is fantastic. I love it, love it, love it. I don't know if we'll have time for what we've been testing today, but I'll go into that someday.
All right. We will go through really quick. There's a video I want to recommend on the Viceland YouTube channel that I think you should watch. It's engineer Dave Sieg, who works on analog motion graphics machines, and it's a really beautiful video about his love of those machines and the type of graphics you can make on those. And it's on the Viceland YouTube channel, which I think we'll hopefully link in the show notes.
Atari Box?
Yes, Atari Box. Woo.
So we had no information about this when the first images came out, other than it might have some wood paneling. Well, it turns out we still have very little information, but we know that it will be about $250, $300, and it will run Linux. And it's going to be funded by an Indiegogo campaign.
Whoa. Yeah.
So that's when you stop and you say, maybe this isn't some big company that's reinvigorating the Atari brand.
Yeah, maybe it's a company that has the Atari license and is putting the logo on a box.
Yeah. So they want to be open sourcey. It's going to run some old Atari software. The only problem is it sounds like a Raspberry Pi. So but it's going to be very expensive.
You're paying for a lot of the design.
Yeah, and hopefully some real computing power. So I don't know. It remains to be seen. It kind of reminds me of the Ouya, which was
about that. The Ouya Kickstarter.
It's a Kickstarter open source TV console.
What a great idea that just failed and
yeah.
Hey, it made it into a Target.
But that was severely underpowered. I mean, where they could go with this is something that actually has a lot of horsepower. And at $250, you would hope it does. So fingers crossed. But we'll see.
That was also $100. The Ouya.
Exactly.
Yeah, this is $300. It's a premium product. I mean. Just for a Linux system?
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess you can play Steam stuff on it. And then a little bit of controversy in terms of video games. Of course, PUBG, a lot of our friends are super into it. But there is a new use Unreal Engine. First of all, it's super related. Epic Games announced they have a game coming called Fortnite.
Okay.
And Fortnite will have a mode that is basically just like Battlegrounds Unknown.
Okay.
Clear Unknown
it
Battlegrounds.
Looks the same. Down happy. Based on the screenshot.
I mean, there's other games like Battleground.
Yeah.
H1Z1.
Yeah, exactly. Yep, that's one. And it's just like they just did it best and they're the most successful. I don't see PUBG having any main competition. They have all the critical users.
Is that a bad thing?
They have all the users.
You think critical mass is a good thing or a bad thing?
Isn't it still technically...
It's still beta.
Beta?
Early access. Yeah.
Early access, yeah.
No, absolutely. That does it for our technology news segment. I also want to use this time to thank the sponsor of this week's podcast. And again, that is Squarespace. Ready to start your new business? Make it stand out with Squarespace, with beautiful templates created by world-class engineers and designers. Squarespace makes it easy to turn your idea into a new and unique website. Showcase your work, blog, or publish content, or even sell products and services of all kinds in just a few clicks. You can customize everything from the look and feel to the settings and the products, and you can use Squarespace's analytics to help you grow your website in real time. Not to mention, everything is optimized for mobile right out of the box. And with over 200 extensions to choose from, Squarespace offers a new way to buy domains. And best of all, there's nothing ever to install or patch. No coding required. And if you have a question, Squarespace has award-winning 24/7 customer support to help you. So make your dream a reality with Squarespace and head over for a free trial. And if you're ready to launch, use the offer code TEST, T-E-S-T, to save 10% off your first purchase of a website or domain. That's squarespace.com, offer code TESS, which supports us and lets us keep recording this podcast.
Now it's time for a moment of science. Just one story this week. What were you guys doing 1.8 billion years ago?
Floating around the universe in various forms, particles.
Stardust.
Well, 1.8 billion years ago, two black holes circled each other and created a ripple that caused a gravitational wave to go across space-time, and we detected it on August 14th.
Thanks, Lego.
This is the fourth detection of a gravitational wave, thanks in part to Lego. What was different about this detection is that we've added a third detector. So LIGO famously has a detector in Washington State and in Louisiana, and these have lasers that run down like a 1 kilometer air tube, if you will, and hit like a mirror that's so precise that you that it reflects back the laser almost perfectly. And so if anything hits that, moves that laser, we detect it on just a microscopic level. So that's the detector we used to figure out this gravitational wave had passed by the Earth. Well, we added a third detector because we all watch movies. Triangulate. That's how we figure out things in, with more precision. So the LIGO detector was able to detect an item's location in the sky in about like a 1,000 degree area. And to give you a reference about what a degree looks like in the sky, a full moon is about a quarter degree in the sky. So this is still like a really big area of the sky that we're looking at. By adding the third detector, which is called Virgo, and it's in Italy, they're able to get that down to 60 degrees of the night sky. So we have a huge, a big improvement in precision of identifying the location of this. That detector turned on August 1st, and just 2 weeks later, they found this thing. So it's not even ramped up.
Wow, that's cool.
Yeah, so it's nowhere near the sensitivity of LIGO.
Were they expecting anything? Wow.
You don't go like, I feel like something happened 1.8 billion years ago and is just about to get to us.
What is that an indicator of? Like how frequent these detections happen?
I think that there is this indication that there are a lot of black holes out there, and maybe this is a common occurrence. I mean, somewhere. Albert Einstein's like, hell yeah, this is what I said. And just a quick note, Science and Star Wars, a series I worked on, is ongoing. We just released an episode called helper droids featuring Mike McMaster and Mike Senna, where we built an R4 that's Watson enabled.
Oh, very cool. And also this past weekend was R2LA. We unfortunately weren't able to make it, a gathering of many dozens of R2 builders in Mike Senna's his home in Southern California. I think Star Wars Show will have a segment on that in the future as well.
The VR Minute, virtual reality this week.
All right, we're going to run by this pretty quickly because we're running out of time. We've been waiting to hear about VR installations in malls, in theaters, and we may get our first one with AMC's recent investment in a company called Dreamscape Immersive. And what they've committed to, it's a $10 million investment, is over the next year or so, in six of their multiplexes in the US and in the UK, they will install the room scale VR installations, 16 feet by 16 feet.
Oh.
Play areas with six people using backpacks and VR headsets.
Using custom software?
Custom software.
Games off Steam.
Yeah, no, custom software, designing experiences for this type of social VR in these 16 foot by 16 foot spaces. Really is reminiscent of those type of demo rooms that we use at conventions.
Yeah.
Right? What they've set up on convention floors. And they're going to do, they'll have full motion tracking, of course, and also haptics, floors, fans, sense, all that kind of stuff.
Do you largely see this as being used for promotional VR experiences that relate to movies, or do you think it's going to be more arcadey?
I don't think it's going to be primarily for that. I think these are going to be boutique attractions that people will pay for and use there, and maybe some occasionally subsidized by things like whatever movie studios are putting out for whatever film.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how they handle volume, because it's always a problem with this is that it takes a long time to get through an experience, and do they have a queuing area for the next set, and like how many sets of equipment do they have ready to go and backpacks on to
you gotta have technicians run it. You can't just have like oh, I'm buying popcorn, but I want a thing of the VR. Okay, send the tech over to put on the headset and wipe off the goggles. Like, they have to prepare for these to either be really popular or in the business plan accommodate them having intermittent business.
And what will it cost? Because that's going to be part of their equation too, is that If their line is too long, they will raise the price, or they should anyway.
Right. And, you know, AMC and other theater chains and multiplexes are in the business of selling concessions. So how does this tie into that business model? Like, they're not going to make a ton of money, six people at a time, you know, at six locations having these VR experiences. It's about selling you $10 popcorn and soft drinks.
Will you be able to reserve a spot, perhaps?
Yeah, that was my question.
Yeah.
That reserves, would be good.
I mean,
then it really becomes like a night out.
It's attraction.
Yeah, exactly.
Like turning the multiplex into your own Disneyland.
Upsell on tickets? Like, you're going to see this movie. Would you like to book a VR experience at this time?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, the getting you to the, they don't care about them. They don't take any of the money from the tickets. So they just want you to buy the ticket, because then you're committed to $15, $20 to be there for at least 2 hours. So be in the room, buy their food, use their entertainment.
Will they do the kind of thing that we've done before, like The Void, where you actually can reach out and feel VR, where they have constructed a space that maps to the VR environment?
It doesn't seem like it, because
that's real next level stuff, and that's the kind of thing you can only do with an installation, which this has the potential to be.
Right, but the question is that scalable?
Consistency?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense for the Star Wars hotel that people are going to be paying thousands of dollars to stay in and have their queue and book their VR training session, but not necessarily for the night out and spending however long before you watch a movie.
By the way, I think all the Imagineers out there actually should be required to go to the speakeasy to get a sense of what that immersion can feel like.
That would be amazing.
I mean, the ones working on the Disney the Star Wars hotel.
Yeah. No, I'm surprised these things aren't more prevalent. A couple of notes on the Oculus side. They had a policy change. You can now get refunds on Rift and Gear VR games and apps in the store.
I didn't realize you couldn't before.
Well, you've never had a reason to get a refund.
Yeah, I guess
so.
I've been lucky.
You can get a refund for any reason if you request within 14 days of purchase and if you haven't played for more than 2 hours, which I think is a pretty sweet deal, because a lot of these experiences, in 2 hours, you get a lot out of them already.
It's similar to the Steam refund.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's the same policy, basically.
Only works for games and experiences and apps, not for content, not for movies or bundles or things like that, or in-app purchases either. So, yep, that's always a good thing, moving that forward. In terms of games coming out, we've been waiting for the Gallery Episode 2, and they just announced a release date for that, which will be in mid-October, October 18th. The Gallery Episode 2, Heart of the Emberstone. We played a little bit at GDC this year.
Yeah,
and I really
was
enjoyed
very
it.
Impressed by that, actually. I backed the Kickstarter because I was back in the day when, you know, the DKs were out, and it's like, I'll back anything VR-related because this is huge and got to put my money behind it. And I made it. I didn't even finish it.
The first chapter.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm glad that it came out and I enjoyed what I played of it. But this,
tonally, it feels like it's completely different.
Episode 2 just felt like next level. It really felt like they had invested a lot of time and money.
And those guys are experimenting with Knuckles controllers, of course. So they're pushing things in VR and making pretty full-fledged AAA experiences.
There's some games that have come out. I don't know if you want to talk about that. Voltron is out now.
Oh.
So if you haven't played that, Voltron VR has been released. I have not played it yet, but I'm excited about that. There was another one. You help me out here. We were going to talk about projections, perhaps, but I haven't.
You're talking about Duck Season?
Yes, Duck Season. That is out from the makers of Hover Junkers.
Yes. We're going to talk about projections because it requires more in-depth talking, but it is a polished as hell 2 to 3 hour experience.
Oh.
Yeah.
That sounds great. If there are any listeners in the Boston area, there's a new VR exhibition at the MIT Museum that opens next week called The Enemy that I've heard a lot about. It basically puts you in the middle of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
Whoa.
So it's a social VR experience where you're doing backpacks and you have to interact with other human beings in VR. And it's supposed to be an incredibly intense cinematic experience as well as a experience where you have choices like you would in gameplay that have very different outcomes. So I'm curious if anyone checks out that exhibition.
All right.
Opens October 5th.
And then one final thing, VRDC, spinoff of GDC, had its fall conference in San Francisco last week. We stopped by, said hi to a few people, but it was also our chance to use Microsoft's new mixed reality headsets and controllers.
Yeah, that was a big deal.
Yeah, and we will have our full impressions again on projections this week. But quickly, this is our second time putting on those headsets. Mm-hmm. What did you think?
I'm a fan of the headset. It's got much better resolution in terms of pixel density than the two main players right now. So that's refreshing to see. It's got about the same field of view, but the tracking, which is inside out, is surprisingly good.
Yep.
I was impressed with the ability for, you know, lack of lag or latency. And the controllers, I had concerns about those going in because, you know, they're only visible to your headset. If you put them behind your head, they are no longer visible. But the games and the apps do a good enough job at compensating for that.
And the thing I did not realize, but totally makes sense, is that the view area for the controllers is much wider than your own field of view.
Yeah, good point.
So you'll never see, if you're looking at your controller, it will always be tracked.
Right.
You never see it untracked. It doesn't mean that you can do things with it when it's untracked, necessarily, but you'll never see it untracked. But we'll be talking more about that in projections. I think that does it for this week's episode. We will next week may learn more about your Prusa i3 Mark II S.
Printing as we speak.
What are you printing?
Oh, my son wants to be Soldier 76 from Overwatch for Halloween.
Wow.
Okay.
And so he found the rifle on Thingiverse.
Whoa.
Comes in about 10 pieces.
Great.
So it's a large.
Yeah.
So we're printing that.
That's
great.
Are you
going to finish it too? Like paint
it? Yeah, we're
going to
paint it. And,
nice.
Yeah.
This is the dream. This is the dream the 3D printer has promised.
Totally.
My kid wants to be this thing for Halloween.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist.
Yeah.
He found the file, and now you're helping him print it, and you guys are assembled together.
I mean, people have been carving them out of foam for a long time, but the fact that we can download it, it's pretty cool.
That's pretty cool.
Anything coming up on Tested real quick?
Yes, we have some new episodes of Bits to Atoms and also Science in Progress on the site for you soon. The last Bits to Atoms project was a pinball project,
yep.
And I think people out there really, really liked it. We also had Anthony Carboni from the Science and Star Wars show and also the host co-host of the Science of the Star Wars show come in and help us build some model kits, so that's on the site. You can check that out. And I think we can say we do have a certain 1:72 scale model kit in studio.
No.
So we'll be checking that out soon.
I haven't seen this yet.
Yeah.
Nice.
All right. Do we have an outro this week?
We do. Submitted 52 minutes ago.
Whoa, fantastic.
Fresh off the...
Wow. What if it's from earlier in this cast? That would freak me
Justin
out.
Justin, a.k.a. Speed.
Hi there, I didn't see you.
Bastard.
Processing. 27-year-old man with black hair wearing glasses looking neutral.
That's my new Twitter bio.
Bastard.
That was great. See you next time.